Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the debrief. It's Dave O'Neill here on my special COVID-19 editions, where I'm just ringing comics, see how they're going. And I thought I'd ring Adam Zwar, comedy legend, who lives overseas in LA now. Let's give him a call, see how he's going. Interesting to talk to someone in the US of A. Hello.
Mate.
Oh, that's much better. Yes, I've just gone to get a new cord from a service station to ring Adam Zwar in LA. So that's an outlay of $9.99. No, I'm good. I'm all right.
Oh, I'm worth it, aren't I? $9.99 for a bit of a chat. Mind you, your Sam Pang one was very good. I really enjoyed that.
Sam Pang, yeah. Well, he, I am taping, I should tell you, at the moment. So.
That's all right. You have to actually, good on you for saying it, because it's illegal not to.
Yes.
I found that out as a journalist.
Oh, did you? Yeah, well, I was trying to remember when I first met you, and I because you've never been on this podcast before, I met you when you were a journalist at...
I rang you up one day, I can't remember what we were talking about, but we... You told me a whole lot of things that you shouldn't have told a journalist, but I protected you.
That'd be right. Yeah. And then we met and with another guy, and you had an idea for a TV show with me and Hughie.
Yeah, Chris Merkshire.
Yeah, Chris.
Yeah, that's right. Chris Merkshire. He's MRKSA is how it's written, and he's gone on to be this massive drama writer who's done like stuff for Netflix and. I mean, in Australia, he wrote The Slap and he wrote Underbelly and that one about the asbestos.
Oh, that was great, yeah.
Anthony Hayes in it.
Yeah.
And now he's gone off and written, all this heavy drama for the BBC and Netflix and Channel 4 in the UK. And, we lost him.
It's fair to say he kicked on.
Because you make more money, of course, writing drama. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. I suppose it's longer form, though, isn't it? Like,
yeah. But even if on a daily rate, you get paid half as much.
Oh, really?
It's actually an outrage, because it's just saying you guys are just having funny.
Just having a bit of a laugh.
You're just having a bit of a nice time. Yeah, a bit of a laugh. Whereas actually, the truth is that anyone who's done drama and then goes into a comedy room knows it's way harder. Because you've got to do the story and you've got to make jokes.
Yeah. Know? Oh, I think it's harder, but you watch some drama shows, you're like, oh, how would you write this? It's so long. I've been watching what on SBS called 000. Have you seen that? I think it's called 000. It's about the drug trafficking around the world, and it's set in so many different countries. It'd be a very complicated whiteboard, put it that way, in the writer's room.
It is. That's what you've got to respect. It's interesting because I have written drama, and you've got to just leave your sense of irony at the door. You can't come in and mock things. You just got to be really earnest all the time. And but it's the same fundamentals in many ways. All writing is just magic in a way. Like, it's like revealing the magic trick. Hiding something and then revealing it.
What show were you trying to do? I think it was like The Man Show. With me and Hughie, but it wasn't like The Man. Is that in the day? I mean, this was like 20 years ago, probably.
It's called Wise Guys. It was based on my column.
That's right.
And we had a meeting with you and your then manager.
Oh, really? Liz.
Who's retired.
Yes.
what was her name?
Liz Adams?
She's lovely.
Yeah,
and we went into Richmond. We met in a cafe in Richmond, and we pitched it to you, and you really liked it. And you bought us coffee, and you said, "Mate, I'm on British Radio money."
Yeah, and now look back at the money I was getting. It wasn't even that good. I thought it was pretty good in the day, but these days people get like, in Sydney they get millions of dollars to do breakfast read. I got nothing like that. Anyway, when you come from being a stand-up comic and you went to breakfast radio, and you got paid in over $100,000, you're like, oh, this is amazing. I'm like, wow.
You can see their lives change. You can see how they change a little bit in that first year of making that kind of money.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're trying to keep a lid on it, but quietly they're just like, they're so stoked inside.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they're buying houses and cars and just moved into a different income bracket. And,
well, that's why they often give up stand-up too, because they go, oh, this is it. This is, I'm bloody radio now. But it's interesting because...
What am I going to do in it?
When you get sacked. What are you doing? Well, the problem is you get sacked eventually. Nearly everyone gets sacked in radio. So
yeah, and they come back with their tail between their legs.
Yeah,
new gear. Yeah,
I know. All the same old gear.
They're sad stories. Sad stories about whatever. What was that station manager at Triple M that everyone hated? And then they used to do bits on stage about him naming.
Him. He's the one that. Tony Moclair, friend of the show, came in one day and he was dressed up in army fatigues with his assistant. And he said, what's going on? He goes, mate, we've declared war on Gold FM. one of the greatest stories ever. We've declared war on Gold FM.
You know he's put work into that one. He's waiting for it.
Told his assistant to put on army fatigues, you know, like for the day.
Oh,
mate. But you were still a journalist then, but then you got... And this was before the internet, really, wasn't it? This is the interesting thing. The internet wasn't really a big thing that time. And you got up, correct me if I'm wrong, you got up to the TV show Wilfred via short films. Is that right?
Yeah, so I'd make a short film every year.
Yeah.
And or a couple of short films a year. That was hard in those days because...
Oh, yeah. Camera equipment was expensive,
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very easy for us to sound like the Four Yorkshiremen, but that was the reality. We had to talk to the guy from Kodak to get the offcuts of the 16mm offcuts that they weren't using that had come back to them. And it was like a drug deal because he would steal the offcuts from work and then you go around and you meet him on the corner of, if I remember, Coppin and Bridge Street, and you'd pay him like $2,000 and he'd give you a whole lot of offcuts. And then he would pocket the $2,000 because he'd taken it from the studio, basically just swept it up. And so that's what we made Wilfred on. And you didn't shoot on digital in those days, so it wasn't very good. And you tried to grade it up to make it look good, but you never did. And so a lot of film festivals just wouldn't accept a digital tape. You actually had to send the print. So that was what, you know... So it was hard to. There was a lot of organisation involved in getting films up. And I remember that was the big thing for me because I was a journalist for 4 or 5 years. I was a journalist for probably 10 years, but 4 or 5 years in Melbourne. And I used to go. I was kind of invited to say opening nights of plays and things like that. And I'd always be on the outside, and they go, "You're that journo guy just hanging around."
Yeah.
And then I made Wilfred, and then suddenly, it changed a little bit. And
yeah, you're inside the tent as opposed to pissing on the outside.
Got the keys. Yeah, got the keys to the executive bathroom.
Yeah.
And
that's an incredible story because you would have been surrounded by cynical journalists going, "What are you doing that for? What are you making your little film for?
Yeah.
Mate, there's a future in newsprint, don't you know? You know."
That's right. That my dad told me to get a job as a journalist, so I get something under my belt now. One's working as a journalist.
Job.
It was exactly. I was that little mascot. I was that little mascot who kind of sometimes appeared in it because I got time off to do ads and things, you know. In an ad or an episode of Blue Heelers, and they think it was really, really cool. And then, but I still was a journo for. So we made the short film of Wilfred, but I was still a journo for another 3 or 4 years until at the same time Wilfred got up the TV series and The Wedge, if you remember rightly.
You got a job on that. Yeah, of course. Wedge. The Wedge. Yeah. And then
and they got me out of journalism.
Yeah, and then you did Lowdown and then Agony and all these shows, and now you're in LA.
I think Wilfred was the escape, though, you know, and I was looking forward to escaping because I wasn't a journalist. I was just bullshitting. I was just, I was pretending to be one because my parents were journalists, so I was able to actually pretend.
Well, you've probably seen both your parents journalists.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I was able to do that in a seamless way, like for them, but I would just do soft puff pieces because
you did a lot of the show business stuff, I remember. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in those days, you didn't have to write about the nasty side of it. You didn't have to kind of go, such and such as having an affair or whatever. You just like literally ring up Dave O'Neill and you'd write a nice story about it.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember those stories.
Yeah. Of course, that don't happen anymore. No. Not really.
I've mentioned your father before. I don't know if it's on this podcast, but certainly on podcasts, how he wrote a book on Rudolf Hess, who I get obsessed by. And your dad, did he go to Spandau Prison? Not meet him, but he met his son. Is that right?
Yeah, he met Wolf Rudiger, his son, and he went, because Hess was in hospital when, got rushed to hospital when Dad was there, and so the jailer, a guy called Colonel Andrus, let Dad inside the prison, Spandau Prison.
Wow.
Which had one prisoner, and that was Hess.
Yeah, Rudolf
all
Hess.
The other Nazis had died at this stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Dad went and lay on his bed, and he sat on his toilet, and he was doing the whole, he really wanted to get in Hess's mind, because he would be smuggling questions like a tape recorder into Spandau, and then he would have a list of questions, and Hess would answer the questions on the tape, and then would smuggle that again. And that was a big thing in our lives, because we had, just for those who don't know, Hess was Hitler's deputy.
Who flew to Scotland in a light plane to try and make a truce with Churchill, but it never happened, and he was locked up for his life, for his efforts. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he pretended to be. It was a conjecture over whether he actually went mad or he pretended to be mad. I think maybe he pretended to be mad. I think he just lost faith in Hitler.
Yeah.
And went, I'm trying to actually going to try and end things here.
But also your father made the great statement that Rudolf Hess, best warm-up man ever. He used to come on before Hitler. and I've quoted this a lot. And he used to come on before the rallies and rouse everyone up and then bring Hitler on?
Yeah, he was the Popey of Germany.
The Michael Pope.
It was...
wow.
Brian Nankervis of Germany.
What a job. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was quite good at that, and Wolf Rudiger it was actually the jailer who gave Dad Hess's diaries, right? And so they were kept under our house, like they were actually put into a brick, into the brick wall, and then it was cemented up. And one night my mum heard some people under the house, and she went downstairs, and there was these two Americans. You have to understand, this is in Cairns and far north Queensland in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
And two Americans under the house, and very close to where the diaries were actually in the wall. They'd been cemented into the wall, and it was like alarmingly close. And she goes, "What are you guys doing?" She goes, "Oh," and they said, "Oh, we're here to offer you a pebbling kind of cover for the pool, for the,
right.
You know, we actually do pool services, and we've got this new pebble thing that you might be interested in." They're both American, and they gave, mum said, "Look, you were not interested, but you better go." And they each gave her a card.
Yeah.
And then in those days, there was only one pool person in Cairns, and Dad rang him up because everyone knows each other in Cairns and said, what are these guys, who you guys, what are they doing working for you? And he said, "Oh, they're literally here on a contract. They don't want any money. It's all going to be commission." And they're great. They went and got their own cards printed up. It was amazing. And Dad said, "Yeah, of course they did. They're CIA.
Oh, they're CIA."
And then when the official, all those kind of papers were released years later, yeah, we saw the whole kind of the whole process of the plans to actually try and get the diaries back.
Wow.
And come to our house and get them and everything.
That's incredible. What happened to the diaries?
So Dad gave them back to Hess's son.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Dad flew to Berlin with them and gave them back to Hess's son. And, yeah, it's a bit of a – it's a kind of a strange thing in our lives because the story fell into Dad's lap, you know, to do the story – to write the book. And – but, you know, he's – Dad's 88 now and he's in – you know – he's in a nursing home and everything. I know it's kind of bit of sweet for him because the book was successful, but he, you know, loathes the Nazis and
yeah, right,
and
yeah.
And the horror. So it's,
what? That's an amazing story. That'd make a good telly movie. Your dad's story would make a good movie. In fact,
I think so too. Yeah, yeah. It's just hard to get up.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have the ability with my comedy credentials to do it.
Yeah,
it's
no.
It's hard to.
No.
But you're right. I've,
it's a good story.
Tried to. It's a great. Yeah, and he's written a couple of books about the actual writing of that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But the most embarrassing thing for me was one day he went on the Mike Walsh show.
Oh, wow.
And. If you just listen to remember that, it was like the kind of.
Yeah, it was before midday. It was midday. It was a midday show.
Before Carrie Ann. And he, you know, he's like, yeah, kind of an Aussie Oprah back in the day. And he, and Dad, because when he was writing the book, we didn't have much money because all the money was just going into the, you know, writing. Well, there was no money, but he was just not earning any money because he wasn't getting paid until delivery.
Yeah, right.
And,
yeah.
So he had this really out of date suit, and he went on the Mike Walsh show. And Mum told my teacher, that my dad was going to be on the Mike Walsh show.
Oh no!
And she thought it'd be nice for the class to watch.
Oh, no.
And the teacher told the headmaster, and suddenly 1,000 kids are watching the fucking Mike Walsh show.
No.
and Dad ended up getting into an argument with Mike Walsh. That's
really?
Sidebar. Yeah, but the second thing is that especially in Cairns in the '80s, you know, that no one wanted the tall poppy. Everyone hated the tall poppy kid.
Yeah.
So I got bullied mercilessly that day, you know. Your dad's a dickhead, my dad thinks your dad's a dickhead.
Yeah. And I shouldn't laugh, but that's
a rough time then.
Oh, that's how old were you when that was shown on TV?
I reckon I was like eight or nine.
God.
So I just start punching on with these kids. The first time I just got so upset if anyone said anything about my dad.
And inappropriate for a children to watch something, a man talk about his Nazi hunting, you know, book.
Different times, Dave.
Different times. Wow. And I should ask.
What was that podcast you did? What was it? It was you and Glenn, and what was the.
Rudolf Hess and Olivia Newton-John, because Rudolf Hess, one of the arresting officers was Olivia Newton-John's dad, who was an expert in German high culture, and so he was brought in to interview Hess because he spoke German and he was very familiar with, he was like an academic who studied high culture in Germany, so.
Because they're a strong Jewish family, the Newton-John, you know, so it's I know
Newton-John
doesn't sound that Jewish, but
I didn't know
they
that.
Are, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah. That's why we talked about it, yeah.
Because they owned a lot of clubs in Melbourne, her father and...
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's, strong Melbourne family. Old money kind of thing.
Well, I was talking to Sam Pang about Grease, how we watched the other night for my daughter's birthday, and Olivia Newton-John was so attractive. So was John Travolta. They're both such a good-looking couple. Is everyone? I mean, you're in LA at the moment. Hit us with a bit of a...
I am.
Firstly, how is it under the COVID? Is it as bad as what it appears on the news, or is everyone out and about now in LA?
Look, it's just what I was going to say, because you mentioned that in your email, and I'm like, how is it different? Well, it's this week the same things happened here that happened in Australia, you know. Restrictions have been lifted. except Australia has, you know, very small number of cases, and LA has got, you know, thousands. And, you know, even up the road at the Ralphs, which is Coles, is like there was a cluster among the employees of Ralphs, and that's like 15 people who have got it.
Wow. So it's kind of widespread there.
It is widespread, and it's interesting how it's kind of very divided country, you know, among, you know, tribal lines, especially Republican, Democrat. And it's very, ironically, you know, it's very prevalent in Democrat areas still, like New York and LA. Still hasn't really hit hard in the kind of Republican strongholds, which is the South.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So, and they're all the ones out, let us out, and they were protesting and stuff, and...
Because they're feeling good. They don't understand. It's such a different place to Australia, America. And, you know, the reason why, who knows why Australia's done so well. Obviously, they got in early and put in place
restrictions
that were going to protect people. And we're obedient, you know, because of our convict past, I guess, we're quite obedient, and we do pay attention to the laws, whereas America is very individualistic.
Yeah, they're like, no, don't take my liberties and all that. You see it on the...
And it's not so prevalent. That attitude is not so prevalent in Hollywood or LA, but it is definitely everywhere else. And not prevalent in New York either, but... everywhere else is like, you know, guns. I'm allowed to congregate. I'm allowed to go to church. Don't take any of these things away. I don't want anyone to have. I don't want to be paying for anyone to have health care.
Yeah. As someone, they always say America's like five different countries. I mean, when you look at the size of it, it's as big as Europe, really. So you could easily have the South, the Midwest, etc. But you're in LA. You're in LA.
LA is different. LA, like New York's more like, the attitude in New York is a little bit more like Sydney and Melbourne. You know, people are a little bit more like that, especially somewhere like Brooklyn, right? That's very much like Melbourne.
Yeah.
LA is a very different place. You know, it's like I struggled when I first got here. You know, it doesn't matter how many books I've read or movies I've seen about, you know, Hollywood and how people treat each other and everything. I still was surprised when I get lied to.
You know? And is there a ruthlessness in LA, that in the showbiz world?
Totally.
Yeah.
They're so friendly. You wouldn't know it. Like if I arranged meetings for everyone who was listening to this podcast and, you know, you all had screenplays to pitch and I arrange meetings for you, you just think, you go in there and you pitch and you think, these are the nicest people.
Yeah.
They're so friendly.
And you'd also think, wow, my show's up. You walk out of the room, you go, someone's told me this, you get the Hollywood yes. I think it was, might have been Eric Banner said, you get the Hollywood yes. You go, that show's obviously up, the movie's up, and then you hear nothing. No, that's not up. It's not. They're just, someone being mean to you in the room.
Well, that's it. If there's nothing, you know, pretty quick. There's no kind of like, hey, what are you thinking? That thing that you pitched us 3 weeks ago, we're actually thinking we're starting to make that. There's none of that. They move quickly. And sometimes, but it's always a shock, you know, to pitch something, have people like it. And there is a kind of an excitement, and you think you're going to sell, and then it just goes cold really quickly.
That's
always a shock.
Oh, harsh.
And it's all in the buyer's favor. So the buyers are the studios or the networks, and so you got to put in a lot of work for free before you get in the room. You know, months work.
Yeah, you've got to You've got to write the script. I heard an interview with the guy who wrote The Black Klansman. Yeah. Those two guys wrote The Black Klansman. They were struggling writers. They wrote the whole script. They had finished the script several times over before they got in to pitch it, basically, by what they said.
Wow.
So, it's a long story. Yeah. I always remember I interviewed Jason Reitman, you know, the director who did Up in the Air.
Oh, yeah.
And he said one day he was trying to get up in the air up, and Mel Gibson, he sent us to Mel Gibson's company, and Mel Gibson rang him up and went, "Man, we love your script. I'm going to be in it. You can direct it. I'm going to produce it. This is happening. We are going to talk tomorrow. This is amazing." Never heard from him again. Never heard from him one time.
Well, that's exactly what it's like.
Yeah, yeah.
And but then another thing that happens, which is probably less bad, but it's still bad, is them buying something, and the moment they buy it, they fall out of love with it.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes it'll just sit there.
Or the person who buys it moves on, and then the next person comes along and goes, "Hey, I don't want that guy's stuff. What? I don't want that."
Oh, for sure.
That happens in Australia.
You sure? That,
yeah.
That happens in Australia too.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, no one wants anything from the previous administration.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, that's... If you could survive a couple of commissioning editors in Australia, you've done really well.
Yeah, you've done well. It's a trivial question, but who's... I ask everyone these questions, but I want to ask you another question. What's the last famous person you saw in the COVID times?
Oh, so that's... I haven't even told Amanda this, so I haven't even told my wife this, but I was literally going for a jog last night, and I jogged past David Spade.
Oh, I love David Spade. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he was just like, and I do the Melbourne thing of not looking.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people in America don't bother with it. They just kind of guileless and just go, "Hey," whereas I don't. I try and just go. I give them that space. I want to be all over them.
Yeah.
But I jog past him. But
was he by himself or was he with a Playboy model?
No, he's with a girl and her dog, a woman and her dog, And he was starting to grow a beard.
Okay.
Yeah, but he's, I'm a big fan of him, his. Do you know Chris O'Dowd from the IT Crowd?
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he lives two doors down.
Oh, he's in Get Shorty. He's great in Get Shorty, the TV
he's
series.
Great in Get Shorty.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
He'd be friendly because he's Irish. He's Irish. Surely he'd be friendly.
He's friendly, but I don't want to say hello to him because I'm a big fan because then he's going to walk past. I walk past him literally three or four times a week.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to go, there's that guy. I've got to avoid him because he's a big fan and I want to talk to him about my career. So I generally do the thing of just like giving them a wide berth. Although I've told Payne the story that one day I was pretty down when I first got here, and I arrived at the Four Seasons Hotel for a meeting. And I get out of my car, and this guy, this kind of middle-aged guy, is standing up. There's a fountain thing. And he's standing up near the fountain, and he's pointing at me. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe that's the guy I meant to meet. I don't know. I'm getting closer to him, and it's Tom Hanks, and he's pointing at me, and I'm looking around, and he's going, "Hey, how are you?" I go, "Hi, how are you?" And he goes, "Oh, sorry, I thought you were someone else."
Mistaken by Tom Hanks.
You know, I'm thinking, things are starting to turn around. Maybe he's seen well for
it. Yeah, maybe. Yes, yes. Yeah, lowdown. Yeah. Big fan. Big fan.
That's right. Maybe he's seen the wedge.
Yeah, maybe. I'm going to ask my questions. As well. What was the last thing you cooked?
Last thing I cooked was a spaghetti carbonara.
Oh, nice. I had that the other night. Yeah.
I've only got about five things on rotation. Hey, I noticed that you didn't... I've got to say, when in the Pang interview, you said you didn't like cafes. I've actually forced you to go to a few cafes. I'm going to remember that now.
Yeah, but no, when I normally meet you, we go to that Chinese place, and that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
That's not a cafe, though.
Oh, that's good.
That's not, I don't consider that a cafe.
No, but I have taken it to friends of mine in Richmond.
Oh, I don't mind that. That's all right. I don't mind.
But you're like Hardy. You need a fizzy drink.
Yes.
There's no fizzy drinks there.
You're talking about Matthew Hardy. Yeah. I like Diet Coke. You're right. And that's when you go to a chicken shop, you know you're going to get it. You know what you're getting in these places.
So you and Peng go to the chicken shop and regularly, semi-regularly?
Yeah, semi-regularly, yes. Yeah.
I'm jealous.
We try to go to different chicken shops So I know them all in the suburbs of Melbourne, but we've been back to the same one a few times where Pang gets accosted by people. It's very funny.
Yeah.
The first time he turned up, he had his man bag with him. I said, mate, you can't bring your pencil case into the, you know, looks like a pencil case.
I remember him when he bought, like, I've been going to Long's in Russell Street with him since 2008.
Yeah.
And so I've seen this slow process of him just like becoming more and more and more famous. And
you were an early adopter of Pang because you had him on your programs and stuff. Yes. Yeah, early on. That's right.
And he was on he was in the original
Agony.
Agony. So that's 2011. He got me on I came on and did the TV section for the Breakfasters in 2008.
Oh wow, yeah, right. You were the TV correspondent. Yeah, right.
TV correspondent. So I came on and did that, and I started became mates with him, and yeah, so no one knew him then. And I remember, I think it must have been 2014 or something. He makes a joke of only earning 12 grand that year.
Yeah.
And now he's like,
loaded.
He's just gone.
Yeah.
It couldn't happen to a more talented person. I mean, nice, you know, I was always going, I hope Australia catches on to this. This guy's hilarious. He's Rickles. He's, as you say, King of Zing.
The King of Zing, mate. The King of Zing. Yeah, it's amazing. But as you said, he hasn't changed. He was always like that. He was like that when he earned 12 grand a year. So he loves.
Yeah, he has not changed.
No. Loves saying no to things. He's one of those guys.
He loves it. Yeah, and he's so, because he's, and you know, this is racist in a way, but he's like so zen about everything. It's like kind of like almost Zen Buddhist about
everything. Yeah, I don't think that's racist. He's quite Buddhist. Yeah.
He just does, the pulse rate never goes up too high, goes down too low. It's always steady. And I've never seen him in any situation. Like, we've been in some, we've been in some live situations, particularly when we're hosting the Paralympics
in London,
which are pretty hairy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the pulse, he never panics.
Never panic.
Pang, I think it must be because that sport, the sport thing, you know, because he used to be quite a good sportsman. So it's just like staying calm under pressure.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, almost played for Collingwood, as he'll tell you. Almost. What was the last thing you watched or listened to?
So I'm watching The Great at the moment, which is pretty good, which is written Tony McNamara, a Sydney writer. So it's about Catherine the Great.
Oh, yes, and, yes. Okay, that's written by the Sydney guy. Yeah, he wrote The Boys. Is that the guy who wrote The Boys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't write The Boys. What did he write?
Oh, he wrote one,
Doctor.
Oh, okay.
He wrote, here we go. What was that John Travolta? What was that John English, Rebecca Gibney sitcom in the 90s?
All the Rivers Run? All Together Now.
No.
All Together Now.
All Together Now.
Yeah.
He wrote for that, and then he wrote, he's writing plays for Sydney Theatre Company, he wrote for that, then he wrote Tangle, and then
Tangle's
he wrote
good. Yeah.
Doctor.
Yeah.
And then he wrote, and on the basis of, I don't know how he sent a play of his to the guy who directed The Favourite and got on board to write The Favourite. And now he's off and running. He's just written The Great, which is really good.
Oh, The Favourite was that movie. It was great, that movie. About the
Olivia Colman.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So he's up and about. And, And he wrote a play called The John Wayne Principle, which did very well back in the 90s as well. But The Great was a play, and then he's turned it into a series. So I've been watching that and listening to, mate. I was just listening to a bit of. I always listen to old dead musicians mainly.
Yeah, right.
Like David Bowie or Johnny Cash or Elvis.
The Kings.
Lenny Cohen.
Good. Yeah. And what was the last bit of human contact you had?
Apart from Amanda, there's a guy called Nathan Lovejoy. He's 6'9", so I go and walk his dog with him, and he's an Aussie actor.
I know Nathan. Yeah, he's very good.
He's a foot taller than me, so it's weird walking down the street with him. But he's good to have a chat to. You know, I mainly talk to Australians here.
Yeah,
I don't have many American friends.
It can happen. My brother lives in Geneva, Switzerland. He hangs out with the guy from Things of Stone and Wood because he moved there with his wife who works for Red Cross. Yeah, and I'm going for a walk with Anton. He's from Brunswick. And we talk, you know, he's a big Carlton fan like yourself, Adam. So he hangs out with other Aussies in Geneva. So,
mate, but haven't they all gone home? Like, there's literally 200,000 Australians who have gone home in the last
three months. It's very true.
And keep reading about them, and I'll be going home soon. I think what happens, you just kind of reach a point where you go, you miss your friends, you miss your family, you miss you don't appreciate when you're living in Australia just how structured things are, and you don't appreciate your system of government.
Yeah, like right.
The Westminster system, forget about the monarchy, but the Westminster system of government where everything has been broken down, all the checks and balances have been thoroughly worked over, right? So you don't, there's not going to be a situation where you have a leader who can be so corrupt and continually be so corrupt and pretty much brazenly fuck you to everything. You can't do that in the Westminster system. Because there's no Jared Kushner who's going to be.
Yes.
Scott Morrison's, son-in-law is not going to ever be telling us what to do because you have to be an elected official to do that in Australia.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing when you look at Trump. Because in Australia, you've got the cabinet too, and they just get rid of prime ministers if they don't like them. We've had enough of you, as we've seen.
That's right. Worst comes to worst, Governor General gets rid of you. There's so much. You can not like, Scott Morrison or Tony Abbott or whoever, but they're never going to get away with too much.
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be some bad decisions that are made. People are going to be sent to war and probably killed. But it's not like this situation where the president just goes, "No, we're going to ignore this virus.
Yeah.
It's not happening. It'll blow over."
And it's then incredible. Suddenly
you wake up and it's 100,000 dead.
Well, Adam, it's been great talking to you.
You too, mate.
It's been awesome. And we'll catch up again when you're in Australia.
Yeah, I look forward to that. I look forward to getting an invitation to a chicken lunch.
With Pang.
With you boys. Yeah.
And check out Adam's podcast, 10 Questions with Adam's Wife. It's on the Nilly Network as well. So there's quite a back catalogue there. And there's some great interviews that you do on there.
Thanks, mate. Your
professional
Thank
interview.
You. Dave O'Neill is, I think, number two.
Number
one or two, I can't remember.
Someone like that. Yeah. Adam's Wife, ladies and gentlemen.